This is EdUp Legal with your host, Deborah Solmore. She's an experienced higher education lawyer, most recently the general counsel for a system of nonprofit institutions, and she's going to be leading conversations about trending legal, regulatory, and compliance matters in higher education, with a focus on leaving out the legalese and making legal easy. Let's hear from your host, Deborah Solmore.
Welcome to another episode of EdUp Legal. I'm your host, Deborah Solmore. This is actually my first episode of 2024, feeling a little bit rusty as I haven't recorded one since before the holiday break. I hope everyone had a nice holiday season. I've been quite busy getting up to speed in my new role as the general counsel at Gateway Foundation, which I have been seriously enjoying, but can't seem to leave my passion for higher education behind me. So I am continuing to host this podcast. So going to get back on track with a series of new episodes. Today, I'm extremely excited to have a conversation with three amazing women from the Middle States Commission on Higher Education. I have Tracy Schneider, the Senior Vice President for Legal Affairs and General Counsel, Bridget Booty, the Director of Policy and Records Management, and Amy Moseder, the Senior Vice President for Policy and Administrative Services. Excited to have you all with me and looking forward to a fabulous discussion. Welcome. So I think people may be wondering, or I guess maybe they'll know because they can look at the title of the episode, three people from an accreditor with such expansive titles, what are we going to talk about today? So today we are going to talk about the recent revisions to MSCHE's third-party provider policy. And before we dive into it, I guess a couple of, brown-nosing statements. One, which is, I just want to say thank you so much to you and to the commission for having myself and Joe Celestio, the founder of EdUp Experience, live at your annual conference. It was so fun to record. It's the first time I ever got to live podcast and actually get to meet Joe in person. So thank you. We had a really, really wonderful time there. We had a lot of really great conversations. So just wanted to say thank you for that.
It was great to have you. I'll step in and say it was wonderful to have you guys there. I know everybody who joined the podcast and listened to the podcast really enjoyed it. And certainly it was my first opportunity, not just to meet you, but to do a podcast. So it was a blast. And now Amy and Bridget are going to join in the fun.
And you were very brave. You just got on the mic that first night and, you know, shared your thoughts, which was wonderful. And a huge shout out to Nicole and Heather for having us and for all the great work that they did. It really was just very, very wonderful. So before we kick this off, I do have to, make a disclaimer, which is that when I took the podcast on, what I really wanted to do was I really wanted to bring higher ed regulatory, legal, and compliance issues to a broader group, not just lawyers, hence my hashtag making legal easy. You can't sort of talk like lawyers. So before someone listening to this says, well, what is a lawyer doing talking about accreditation? I want to sort of make an asterisk and say, I firmly believe that at its core, accreditation is an academic process. But that said, there are definitely situations where it becomes a legal one as well. And so I think it is perfectly appropriate. I'm going to selfishly say that since it's my podcast. It is perfectly appropriate for lawyers. I know Tracy, you're the other lawyer on our call, to be talking about, you know, sort of the accreditation process. So with that, I'm going to sort of dive in. And can we talk a little bit about first, what was sort of the impetus for the commission to need to and want to sort of update and address the question of third-party providers? I don't know who wants to kick that off.
I'll take that one.
Great. Thanks, Amy.
The third-party providers, policy and procedures, they were part of the commission's planned policy review schedule. So it was on a schedule of just for regular review. This policy and procedures were designed to address some of the questions that we had got when the commission rolled out the 2014 standards for accreditation, because those had specific criteria for third-party providers. So we did some guidelines. We had third-party providers guidelines that we issued in July 1, 2019. And we had some other related documents on education-related contracts and international relationships that were older. So we definitely wanted to consolidate information that was in these different documents, as well as create stronger cross-references to related processes like substantive change, which are a little bit more nebulous and difficult to understand. So I do think this and other commission policies demonstrate that one of the commission's goals of our policy agenda is a focus on students. So it was, with that goal, it was important that we were clear that the institution is responsible for third-party providers that deliver services and programs on the institution's behalf, and that the institution really must disclose accurate information and be fully transparent about these relationships.
And I like that sentence, which appears at the very beginning of the policy, which is basically you, the institution, are responsible for the content that delivers regardless of who delivers it.
That's right.
I know that you took comments in connection with the revisions of the policies, and I am going to assume that that is part of the general process when you're revising policies. And you actually released a summary of the comments, which was really fascinating. Did you get as many comments as you thought you would? Like, how does that process work? Do we have, you know, the same sort of repeat commenters, or do the comments really help drive what you're aiming to do as your final work product? I'm always fascinated what happens with the comments behind the scenes.
Well, I can start us off on this one, and then I think Bridget can probably chime in and explain a little bit more about the process. But I will just say that, and I think we'll probably talk about this at some point, so I don't necessarily want to get too deep into it now, but I do think that we weren't surprised by the fact that people wanted to provide comments on this particular topic. So I don't know that I would say we anticipated the number, the breadth. I don't know that we had a real idea of what that would be, but I do think that we weren't surprised that on this particular topic, which had gotten some attention from the Department of Education and has gotten attention in the media with different arrangements that institutions have, I don't think we were surprised that people were going to have comments. And I think we always hope that our institutions in particular are interested in our policies and procedures and want to provide those comments. So I think this one we knew was going to get a little bit of attention, but then I'll let Bridget share a little bit more about our process because we do it for our policies and procedures as part of a routine practice too. So it wasn't just for this one.
Sure. And we always encourage at the commission as part of our policymaking process, public feedback. It's part of, it's a critical part of the review. It's part of us understanding sort of what we may need to tweak or revise in response to some of the feedback that we get. And so we do take all of our comments into consideration that are submitted to us. This one in particular had a few comments, and like Tracy said, we were not surprised by it. We knew that there would be some questions that came along with everything. And the comments that we found the most helpful were the ones that offered us real kind of practical solutions for maybe gaps that they had identified in our policy. So we had a few that said, you know, you should address this component of the policy here, or, you know, this general idea about third-party providers. And we do incorporate that in there. One thing that I think maybe you don't see behind the scenes is as part of the public comment process, we process everything that is in there. So it goes in a spreadsheet. We note the themes just to really get an idea of those gaps that we can plug in as part of the policy.
I think I've said this on, you know, prior broadcasts. I'm a bookworm nerd. I love to read. And so now I guess I'm going to confess, as sad as it is, I'm a Federal Register nerd as well. And so I often find that reading the comments and the preambles to when the department issues new regulations is just so enlightening from an operational standpoint, because I think some of the people that read the regulations, and I always say with a policy or a regulation, I'm also a flowchart nerd. I jot diagram everything out. You're getting people who are actually going to have to operationalize these. And so they give you a sense whether, you know, whether the accreditor or the regulatory agency takes those comments and makes any changes, I do think it's really fascinating to read them from an operational standpoint. And I know, Tracy, you had something you wanted to weigh in on.
Yeah, I actually think that your comment, Deborah, is in line with what I wanted to talk a little bit about too. Our public comment process, we do as part of our regular practices, as Bridget has shared with you, we find it incredibly valuable. We take value in the comments that we receive and we utilize them in a particular way, but we aren't the same process that the Department of Education or any administrative agency would be using for their rulemaking process. And I think for people who are a little bit more familiar with that process, the Federal Register, the Administrative Procedures Act, would expect a certain comment period. And then they would expect certain summaries that would come out of that particular comment period because they're required by law.
Correct.
For us, they're not. We do engage in that process because we value it, because we've established procedures that allow us to engage in that process and to get that feedback from our institutions. That opportunity for feedback is in our bylaws. We are encouraged in our regulations that govern our recognition process to always receive that feedback from our institution. So, but it isn't exactly the same process as the Department of Ed uses. And I think sometimes people are a little bit confused by that because they expect a particular comment period, or they expect to see the summary laid out in a particular way because that's how an administrative agency has to do it. And I just, accreditors aren't bound by those same requirements. So we do it because we've engaged in that process. We've chosen to engage in that process and we find value in that process, but not because we have the same structured timeframes and timelines as say the Department of Education or any other administrative agency would have.
I think that's a great point. And I would sort of take your point one step further, which is not every accreditor does it the same. So, you know, if you're an institutional accreditor, you might be familiar with their process, but, you know, so I come from a system where not every school was accredited by the same accreditor. And so you're really looking at different accreditors do it differently, and that's okay. And I think that goes to your point, right? So you really want to understand what your accreditor, how your accreditor is doing this. So before we dive into sort of the policy itself and the procedures, let's talk about the thing that I think were in a lot of people's minds when this popped up, which is you take the word third party and then you sort of put provider, and the Department of Ed says servicer, and suddenly you've got sort of this storm that blows up in light of the fact that your process came not that long after everything that happened with the Department of Education trying to, I'll go on record and say, expand the definition of who is or isn't a third-party servicer. So let's sort of tackle from each one of your perspectives, what is your policy and what is it not as it relates to what the department was trying to do with third-party servicers? So I'll give whoever wants the floor first, but I think each one of you has great perspective on this, so I'd love to hear from all of you.
Definitely going to start us off on this, because it is certainly one of the areas where we were most excited to be able to provide some clarification about the misperceptions in what people thought were direct connections between our policy and procedure and the departments. And yes, I mean, certainly, if we made the distinction between provider and servicer, that is certainly one of the distinctions we can make, but is not really the one that we want to focus on, because it really, I don't think, sets the stage for the most significant difference between ours and the Department of Education's. And that most significant difference is the purpose. So our primary purpose, always, but in particular when it's with regard to the third-party providers, was a focus on the design and delivery of the student learning experience, of related student support services, and for the assessment of programs. And you heard Amy talk earlier about the revision to our standards and how this third party provider policy tied to the revision of our standards. And that is because we directly incorporated into the 14th edition of our standards for accreditation and requirements of affiliation, direct references to third party providers. When we did that, those went into standards 3, 4, and 5. Standard 3 is the design and delivery of the student learning experience. Standard 4 are student support services. And standard 5, just on a broad stroke, is assessment. And so the focus of our third-party providers policy and procedures was really on that student experience. We wanted to make sure that the policy and procedures provided necessary guidance, transparency, maybe some clarity for our institutions on navigating these relationships. It was bringing together a few different documents and processes that we already had in place for third-party providers and connecting it in a way that made the most sense to our standards that we had just revised. And the way that the commission was planning to and continuing to seek to review these relationships. Now, I was not part of the department's guidance or developing the third-party provider's guidance. I don't speak for them. I don't intend to speak for them. And I really am not here to speak to the intent of their guidance or what they were trying to accomplish with their guidance documents, their dear colleague letters, and what they were trying to accomplish. But just on the face of those documents, their purpose was rightfully the administration of Title IV funds and required reporting. That's the department's focus. It wasn't our focus. By way of their content, Deborah, you alluded to it, and I'm happy to say it too, because the commission made a public comment in this regard, but it is significantly broader. They were encompassing a significantly broader set of standards, contracts, relationships than our policy and procedure. And it is that the breadth of what the department was trying to tackle that is the reason why we actually submitted a public comment to the department's guidance expressing concerns about the reach of their guidance. And we did that publicly. So I'm not saying anything that's speaking out of turn, but at the same time, we were in the process, the regular policymaking process of developing our third-party providers policy and procedure. And so I can say that since those things were happening at the same time, since we thought there was too much breath maybe in the reach of the department's document, we were careful to tailor ours in a way that we thought was only doing what was necessary to ensure the quality and integrity of those relationships and to protect that student experience. So I think the purpose is really the most significant difference between, and it is the purpose of accreditation and the purpose of what we do normally is to protect students and to protect the student experience in our institutions. And that's what ours focuses on. It's not about reporting requirements. It's not about the administration of Title IV funds. That's the department's focus. But ours is about protecting students and ensuring that student learning experience. I think that's the most significant.
Yeah, and I think that this was one example where the public comments really did give the department pause to say, well, did we really mean for the reach to go? And again, since this is not a podcast about the third party servicer guidelines, there were examples that were given that you have to think the department said, oh wow, that's not where we intended. So I totally understand and respect that your purpose was different, and maybe the timing of the two happening around the same time was poor for both of you. But I appreciate that, and I think people listening will appreciate that as well. Amy, do you want to sort of share your perspective on the difference between what the department was trying to do and what you all were trying to do?
Yes, so I think it really does flow from what Tracy said, but the department's process is really a monitoring and reporting process for anyone related, to the administration of Title IV. For the commission, it is within the context of our standards, and so it does focus on the types of services that directly impact students, and the commission is not asking for every single, for the institution to report every single third party provider they work with. It is about the institution's process, how they review and approve their relationships with these providers. And we do ask them to provide evidence during accreditation activities, during the self-study. But we're looking at an approach, the institution's approach to working with these to make sure that they, are maintaining oversight and that they are careful about representation of the program and representation of the third party.
And we'll sort of get to that as the next topic, which is what does the policy say and mean, and what should an institution who's reading it, be thinking about when to get in touch and all of that. But Bridget, I want to give you an opportunity to share your perspective on this.
Yeah, I think Amy and Tracy did a really wonderful job of sort of explaining the philosophical and sort of content meaning behind it. From a policy administration perspective, there was really that need, as Amy touched upon, like for the impetus to consolidate information and update it and bring it into where it needed to go. So it aligned really with what we were trying to do with updating the standards. And we also wanted to get these older documents that were related to third-party guidelines, the contracts, and the international programs piece up to date and in one place, just to make it easier for institutions to reference. So part of it also comes from an efficiency standpoint too, and making sure that institutions know how to access information, and that in doing that and combining them, they have up-to-date guidance, and that we're approaching things from the perspective that we want to in terms of third-party delivery.
Okay. Amy?
Yeah, if I could just add one more thing, which is we did receive comments, and they actually called our policy and procedures TPS guidance, so we could see the conflation happening, but...
I can jump in too, because actually my comment was going to be right in line with Amy's comment. We did have, I think we understood why people were initially connecting, not just from timing, but we did have reference to the departments. I knew it, Amy. So I'll start and then Amy can come back in with her thoughts too. We did have reference to the department's guidance initially in our proposed version of the policy before the public comment part. So Deborah, to your point, that public comment part worked for the department, it also worked for us. We were able to see how the connections were being made, and we were able to clarify. And then I'll let Amy tag in, because I think she's going to talk about how and why we clarified.
Yeah, I do. I apologize for that. The commission as an accreditor is responsible for making sure that institutions meet federal regulation as well. And so Bridget was talking about, we consolidated the content and the points and the things that institutions need to do. Part of our oversight is making sure that they do what they need to do for the department. And that was the intention of, the reference in the original draft, was to say the commission we don't do the TPS. We don't require that you report every TPS to us, but we do require that you meet that federal regulation.
I think that's so interesting. And I'll just share sort of my perspective, is that I have been a site reviewer for accreditation review for WASC. I'm actually doing my second site review now, in the middle of a team right now. And the first time I did it, it was interesting to sort of be working with the accreditation standards on our team, but also this piece about, okay, you need to look at federal compliance, which then gets into, I guess from a lawyer standpoint, gets into, well, which is that really outside of the wheelhouse of what the accreditor is supposed to be looking at? So that's a whole nother podcast. But I think as a lawyer on the review team, I think people liked that, because they were like, oh, we'll give it to the lawyer who can sort of look at that stuff. I get like the corporate governance, I get the organizational structure, Tracy's raising her hand. I know you can't see her on video, but I kind of feel like I get all the quote unquote, and I'm using air quotes, good stuff on the site review team. But I think you wanted to add something as well.
It is a completely separate podcast to be talking about navigating, making sure institutions comply with applicable law, but also to see hopefully accreditation as a much larger issue than just compliance with the law. And I think that's what we're really trying to get at. Our policies and procedures are those larger issues. We're not just saying go comply with the department's guidance. We're not saying go comply with department's guidance that was put on pause. Certainly, we are not trying to further the department's guidance. We are trying to ensure the quality of the student experience for our institutions. And I'll also, one additional thing that I'll share before we move on to our next topic is that I think when the department had guidance on third-party servicers, which given its name attached directly to, or people attached directly to our guidance on third-party providers, which is where we started this conversation.
But and it's they are not the same. That is the takeaway from that part of the conversation.
And it's the department's guidance, though, has other areas of guidance which touch on this issue, which are still in effect. Written arrangements are not the exact same thing, but they are a related issue. They are one way that institutions have third-party providers. And that department's guidance on written arrangements is still in full force and effect. And so there are some aspects of compliance with the department's requirements that are still connected to our third-party providers policy. It's just not the third-party servicers that got put on pause that I think happened around the same time. But that doesn't mean we still don't connect in to some of the department's guidance in a way that relates to this topic, but isn't exactly the same thing. But it does relate to the substantive change and probably some of the other things that we'll talk about.
So I think that's a great clarification. And I just want you to know that I read between the lines of that last answer, which was, Deborah, I'd like to come back on another episode and talk about compliance with federal law. And to you, I say, Tracy, I extend that invitation and thank you for offering so we can schedule that when we
Deborah,
stop
you
recording.
Know me so well. It's our second podcast and you
there
already
you
get me.
Always trying to find new topics. So that's great. Okay, so I think we've done a really good job of the why, the how, and differentiating and distinguishing between TSP, third-party providers, and third-party services, TPSs. So now let's talk a little bit about the substance of the new sort of policy and procedure. And maybe I'm going to direct this first question to Amy, because we have a policy, and then we have a procedure. And as a general counsel, I cannot tell you how many times I get asked, well, it's in the policy. Do I now have to come up with separate procedures? And then do I also have to have like SOPs, and which is the official one and which isn't? And I think for, you know, lawyers and compliance professionals and policy writers who don't do that for a living, that's always sort of like a mind blow. So Amy, I'm going to sort of kick off with you. Policy and procedure, why both? And you know, what do you want people listening to know about the distinctions between the two of them?
Yeah, thank you for this question, because the commission was very intentional about this, and there are a variety of ways that people can do this, right? There isn't one rule that you must have a policy and separate procedures. But for us, that worked. And we established a framework that is built on that. So there is a policy document. There's going to be for each policy a related set of procedures. And then we put additional guidance, if we have that, and if it's necessary, into a guidelines document. So we make a very clear separation, and we can have a suite of documents that are related to a particular topic. But this is important, and I'd really like to emphasize this, that for us, the policy establishes the fundamental principle. And while it tends to be shorter and more direct, it actually contains the most important statement the commission is making about the topic. And it is intentionally a broad statement about what the commission expects. The procedures are very designed to be the steps or course of action that we expect them to take to implement the policy. They are more practical in nature, and we have been working very hard over the past 6 years to make them practical. And they are carefully crafted to account for the diversity in our membership. The procedures...
I'm going to just stop you for a second, because mm-hmm. I think that's a really important point. And I think that sometimes gets lost by the institution, and institutions tend to think that all of the institutions, they know they're not, but they tend to sort of think in terms of, well, my accreditor accredits lots of institutions like me. And I know when we chatted a little before we hit record, you made this point about the diverse membership and the lack of being too specific. So I think that's a really great point. And so I guess I want to just stop you and say, if there's anything more that you want to say on that topic, I think it's probably worthwhile, because I think that will give context to your institutions.
Yep, certainly. So we the language, right? It's the art of policy language, which is to be able to provide the flexibility to institutions that are different. And sometimes that means that you lack specificity. And I think a lot of institutions want more information in these procedures directly related to their type of institution. And we intentionally don't do that so that we can apply, you know, like I said, to our diverse membership. It is interesting. That's why we do guidelines sometimes, because we can provide that more specificity, and we can be a little bit more casual about saying, if you are this type of institution. But for an institutional accreditor in particular, we are crafting policy language that is going to be more applicable and a little bit more broad.
And then, Bridget, sort of what's your perspective on the actual what of the policy from your role at the commission?
In terms of like how it gets crafted or...
Yeah, and I guess also what institutions listening are going to want to take away from this and say, okay, you know, I listened to the podcast and now I have sort of a different insight about what's on the piece of paper and how I should be thinking about it and how I should be going back to other, you know, individuals in my institution and saying, hey, this is what I learned about it that I might not have known from reading the piece of paper.
Yeah, I think Amy did.
I'm putting you on the spot. I hope that's okay.
No, that's totally fine. Okay. We were prepared for it. No, I think Amy did.
Yeah, Tracy probably told you she's going to just ask you a bunch of questions that she didn't prep us for.
It's all good.
Okay, good.
So I think Amy did a really wonderful job of just kind of talking about the diversity and the breadth of institutions. And that's what we pay special mind to in our policies. And also in the policymaking process, you know, we can't say everything that we want to say there because of those nuances in the institutions that we serve. And as another component of there, sometimes there are things that we have to put in the policy, like the adherence to federal regulations or any sort of applicable laws that really need to be in there. So I think the work of the nuance and the carefulness and the flexibility that we can give is done in the guidelines, like Amy said. And we try to break things down as much as we can in those supporting documents. So the policy is really kind of what everything is built off of. And then all of that supplemental, for lack of a better term, information like the guidelines, or occasionally we will publish or do trainings on different policies, is really to kind of give more informal, here's what's going on. Let's break down this law or regulation that you might not understand that's referenced in the policy. So we do approach our policies and our policymaking process with our institutions in mind, and kind of giving them understanding and flexibility in their own development of what they need to adhere to, and then also what they need to know to break it down for themselves. It's always a consideration with us.
And so I would love to chat with you all day long about this, because this is just fascinating, but I think I'm going to have to sort of kind of try and wrap it up. So I think the last thing I would ask is for each one of you is sort of a takeaway. I'm an institution accredited by MSCHE. I have a new relationship I'm thinking of entering into with a provider, and I've read the policy. I'm not sure. I'm confused. I don't know what my next step should be. What's the guidelines or takeaway for how do I ensure that I'm interpreting the policy correctly? Well, I guess you can't help me ensure I interpret it correctly, but I have questions. What should I do to make sure that I don't run afoul of the policy and that, you know, I'm in compliance with it and I'm doing what the commission expects me to do with it? So I'll start with you, Tracy, and I'll go around the room and then I will say thank you.
So I'm probably the worst person to start with because I'm going to honestly say that I can't give them direction on how to comply with our policy, but luckily we have a
darn. And I thought I'd built such a great rapport here. I was going to get that from the lawyer. Okay.
We have an entire team of individuals, and two are sitting right here, and they can answer all of those questions. But there are other people in the organization who assist our institutions all the time in answering those questions, and those are the vice president liaison. So it's not typically me, but it is Amy, Bridget, and the institution specific vice president liaison who can answer all of those questions about how to interpret the policy to their circumstances, whether or not, and we make these determinations all the time, whether or not a particular arrangement, a particular partnership is going to be something that the commission needs to review. And it's not just, again, review just for the purposes of checking a box and saying that we've reviewed it. It's review for the purposes of understanding what that relationship is and how it impacts students. So there are number of mechanisms that our institutions have. It may not be through me, but it definitely is through the vice president liaisons and our policy team. So I will leave the rest of those explanations to them.
Yep, I'll add to that Bridget and I take questions through policy@msche.org. We do answer these within the context of the institution. And a VP is going to do that as well, very well, because they have, a caseload. They have a group of institutions that they work with regularly and that they know well. So I think that that's best. The questions are often about, something specific or a nuance that really has to do with the way the institution works. And there are really a wide variety of these types of arrangements and the different types of services. So the questions are welcome. And we do that as a regular part of the sub change process through screening and through, deciding, yes, this one would need to go through the sub change process. And then in general, an institution really should focus on the overall policy statement, the fact that the commission is concerned with how institutions manage these. So stay focused on the broader policy statement. If you have a process, it's documented, and you regularly assess and evaluate these, you're going to be, working in compliance. You do need to keep an eye on them, improve them, and have a really solid process. That is the major goal.
That's great advice. Bridget, anything you want to add?
Yeah. Periodically at the commission, we do offer programming and training on our policies and procedures as part of our event schedule. And so third-party providers is no exception. So we do really structure our events around what institutions need to know, whether that's through general accreditation activities or new policies and procedures that may be published. So institutions can go to our website and look at our spring webinars, and Tracy wants to add on to that, so I'll hand that off to her.
I will add on to that, and I think I will also say part of what the webinars are designed to do is we don't sit here saying that we've captured every single arrangement or situation or circumstance in our policy or thought about it before. Institutions are entering into different agreements, partnerships all the time. And so there may always be something that, we hadn't actually thought about, or maybe something that we have to clarify. And so when Bridget talks about the trainings and the webinars, it is very much to explain parts of our policies and procedures, but it's also an opportunity for us to share additional information that may not have previously been shared, or may not, a question that may not, that have come from a number of different institutions that Amy and Bridget put together from the communications that they've received and that we want to broadly share with our institutions is an additional component that we want them to think about, or an additional piece of guidance that we want them to have. So even if it's not formalized in our guidance documents, we do that through our trainings. And I will also leave with this comment, and Amy and Bridget may also have something to share based upon this, but we do actually take comments on our policies throughout the year, not just when they're going through the revision process. And they're both nodding, though no one else can see them. So I'm going to let somebody else talk about that. But that's another great way that if somebody still has a comment, they can still share it with us.
Yeah, we will take those comments at any time. If we are in the middle of other policy work, and we do have a very full plate, we do keep track of those issues, and we will track it for the next revision. So we keep track of it all.
So, and really what Amy and Tracy are saying is just that emphasizing our commitment to public comment as part of our policy process. That's, I hope, part of the takeaway of this is that people understand we value the feedback that is provided. It helps inform our work and maybe sort of things that we might need to address that we may have overlooked. It's why we publish the summary of comments for the first time for third-party providers. And it's really just an invaluable part of our policymaking process.
I think these are all such wonderful takeaways. And I will sort of, I guess, close by adding on to this idea that institutions are entering into all kinds of new arrangements. And I really do believe that, you know, necessity is the mother of invention right now, and that, you know, higher ed continues to face significant challenges on so many, you know, on so many issues and across a broad spectrum. And I love, you know, I think higher ed is sort of slower to adapt than sort of general corporate America to advances and change. And so I love the things that I'm reading about that institutions are trying to do to, you know, to stay afloat, to keep their brand, to keep, you know, and so having an acknowledgement that we have this policy, yes, you need to follow it, but we understand it's not the be all and end all. And I want to go back to Amy, your comment about we accredit so many different types of institutions and we're willing to work. So I cannot thank the three of you enough for taking time to actually sort of talk openly and so transparently about the why, the how, the what. I think this is just an amazing subject and a great way to kick off the new year of podcasts, especially since I have been remiss in the last, I guess, month or so about recording any. So thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time. And I look forward to continued conversations and Tracy to having you back to talk about compliance with federal law. So thank you. I appreciate it. Have a great, we're on a Friday. We're recording on a Friday. So have a great weekend.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Deborah. Thank you.